Welcome back to The Breakdown with me, NLW. It's a daily podcast on macro, Bitcoin, and the big picture power shifts remaking our world. What's going on, guys? It is Wednesday, April 24th, and today we are talking about SEC lawyers resigning over DebtBox. Before we get into that, however, if you are enjoying The Breakdown, please go subscribe to it, give it a rating, give it a review, or if you want to dive deeper into the conversation, come join us on the Breakers Discord. You can find a link in the show notes or go to bit.ly/breakdownpod. Well, friends, first of all, an apology is in order. You may have noticed that there was not an episode yesterday, and that was for a very good reason. If you happen to follow me on Twitter, which of course you should, at NLW, you probably saw a video of my car completely engulfed in flames in my driveway. We have no idea what happened. My wife had come home from an appointment, had driven just about 5 minutes, no problems, and when she pulled in, it was smoking. By the time I got out there, the white hood of the car looked like a marshmallow, and about a minute later, flames were spewing up from the hood, and before the fire department could get there, the entire thing was completely gone. Absolutely wild, but here we are. So anyways, I wanted to get this one out a little bit earlier, and then we will be back on track for the rest of the week. So, speaking of setting things on fire, two SEC lawyers have been forced to resign following the scandal erupting from the DebtBox lawsuit. You might remember that this case featured the SEC making false statements and misrepresenting evidence to the court in pursuit of an emergency restraining order. Making it much worse, DebtBox was not present at the initial hearing to defend themselves, leaving the court to rely solely on representations made by the SEC. The misrepresentations were related to closure of bank accounts and the movement of funds overseas, neither of which were occurring. The restraining order was granted, allowing the SEC to freeze the project's bank accounts, along with personal bank accounts of founders. Now, I'm using pretty highly critical language to describe all this, but we had a situation here where these founders' individual personal lives were extremely impacted. One of them got stuck in a foreign country, another one wasn't able to pay their bills. The point being that there were real human consequences to these decisions. It's also important to note that the courts trust government agencies when they say they need these types of powers. They trust government agencies not to abuse these types of powers. It's why they were willing to grant these extraordinary powers without hearing from the other side. Ultimately, once SEC lawyers were informed of their errors, they failed to correct the court record, making the whole situation appear to be a deliberate tactic. When push came to shove, the judge reviewed SEC conduct and found that there had been a, quote, gross abuse of power. The judge took the extraordinary step of sanctioning the SEC's conduct, making them liable for legal costs. He found that the SEC had made, quote, materially false and misleading representations. Legal experts noted that government agencies typically receive the benefit of the doubt in court, as we were just discussing, with the assumption that they are beyond reproach. Commentators were unable to find a single prior example where a government agency had been sanctioned for this type of conduct. Bloomberg reporting claimed the pair of SEC lawyers had been told they would be terminated unless they resigned. They had been the lead attorneys on the case based out of the SEC's Utah office. Bloomberg identified the lawyers as Michael Welsh and Joseph Watkins. After the sanctions were applied, the SEC responded to the court. They admitted that their lawyers, quote, fell short of standards, but called the sanctions unwarranted. The agency claimed they will now mandate additional training for attorneys. An SEC investigator later said that a miscommunication had led to an error being made. The case is still ongoing, although the SEC has applied for it to be dismissed, with the option to renew proceedings in a fresh lawsuit. DebtBox have requested the SEC pay $1.5 million in legal fees and other costs incurred. This case crystallized the idea that the SEC is willing to not only aggressively litigate, but also to break the rules in their pursuit of the crypto industry. It has become the number one example that can be cited outside of the industry to demonstrate that the SEC is currently acting in bad faith. Senate Republicans took the opportunity to blast the SEC for conducting itself in what they called an unethical and unprofessional manner. They suggested that, quote, other enforcement cases brought by the commission may be deserving of scrutiny. More broadly, the case calls into question the regulatory strategy that has permeated this administration. The most telling quote comes from Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor, who heads up antitrust litigation at the DOJ. On his first day in the role in 2021, he reportedly asked his team to raise their hands if they had never lost a case. He responded by saying, "You guys are the chicken shit club. If you're not losing cases, you're not going after the right people, because you're just going after the easy pickings." This style of gloves-off litigation has been embraced by the SEC, who seem entirely indifferent to bringing a losing case as long as they are going after who they see as the right people. Last January, former SEC Chair Jay Clayton confirmed that Gary Gensler's agency had taken this strategy on board. He said, "That is a fundamental shift in how we as Americans view the role of government. I don't want to be in a place where I know the government is going to bring cases that they think they're going to lose. This is an ethos now. Unless we're losing, we're not bringing enough cases. That might be fine for private litigants, but when you have the power of the state, you're supposed to only bring cases and make rules you think are going to pass judicial muster." Outside commentary focused on whether this was more accurately framed as the actions of two rogue litigators at a regional office, or if the rot goes all the way to the top. Fox Business journalist Eleanor Terrett noted that both Welsh and Watkins had only 1.5 years of experience at the SEC. That would mean they joined up after the Luna crash, but slightly before the FTX collapse, and well before the litigation commenced against Coinbase and Binance. Fortune reporter Leo Schwartz gave a diplomatic answer, tweeting, "I think it's clear that there's been an aggressive litigation strategy that comes from above, but it's still possible there were overly eager regional trial attorneys acting recklessly." Others were completely incredulous that junior attorneys would act this way without a clear mandate. Brain Genius, an anonymous securities lawyer, wrote, "They were told they'd be fired if they didn't resign. Now SEC lawyers know that Gary will hang them out to dry when they backfire from his aggressive, disingenuous approach to the law gets out of hand. Disgusting behavior all around. If not directly sanctioned by Gary, this behavior was at a minimum a product of the culture being fostered at the SEC by its leadership. Legit disgraceful, but should put some fear into the hearts of SEC attorneys being asked to make some questionable arguments." Crypto attorney Collins Belton commented on this being framed as a resignation, tweeting, "In my opinion, this is, to use precise legal terminology, bullshit uterus. Two staffers getting pushed out while the managers of malfeasance seemingly go unscathed is a joke. This wouldn't be acceptable if the situation was reversed and a law firm tried this. One of these guys is a fourth or fifth year lawyer. The other has practiced for 10 years. While he's more senior, he's not allowed to solely make decisions on behalf of the entire SEC enforcement. So either more heads should be rolling, or these guys are being sandbagged hard." The judge in the case had specifically weighed in on this topic, finding that there was, quote, "pervasive misconduct demonstrating a pattern of organizational bad faith and broadly implicates the commission itself." Finance lawyer Scott Johnson renewed the call to refuse to hire former SEC lawyers, tweeting, "Imagine hiring a lawyer that works for an employer that fosters and excuses this behavior until a judge has to step in." Gross, 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 gross. Hello, Breakers. Today's episode is sponsored by Ledger. As another cycle ramps up, it's another chance to think about your Bitcoin custody best practices, and of course, to help all the new folks do the same. Ledger is the global platform for securing Bitcoin and other crypto. Ledger combines both hardware wallets and the Ledger Live app to offer the best way to buy, sell, swap, and stake without sacrificing on security or self-custody. Ledger features cutting-edge technology in the form of a certified secure chip and a proprietary operating system, but also brings ease of use. This makes Ledger a safe and secure way to manage your digital assets without all the stress. Check out the link to the Bitcoin Ledger Nano in the show notes. 5% of all sales of the Bitcoin Ledger Nano go to support Bitcoin development. Thanks once again to Ledger for supporting The Breakdown. All right, Breakers. Consensus 2024 marks the 10th gathering of the biggest event that's devoted to all sides of the crypto, blockchain, and Web3 ecosystems. Join pioneering thinkers and builders as they delve into the future of DeFi and explore game-changing tech, from AI to ZK proofs and everything in between. The event is 3 days of jam-packed content, networking, and so much more. Some of the speakers at the event include Chris Dixon, the founder and managing partner at A16Z Crypto, Sergey Nazarov, the co-founder of Chainlink, Kathy Wood, the CEO of Arc, Hester Peirce, commissioner, of course, from the U.S. SEC, and Tom Emmer, Republican Majority Whip for the U.S. House of Representatives. Visit consensus2024.coindesk.com to learn more and save 15% on registration with the code BREAKDOWN. That is 15% on registration with the code BREAKDOWN. Before we get back to the breakdown, I want to share something fun we have coming up on Superintelligent next month. Superintelligent is, of course, our new platform for teaching people how to use AI in a way that is much more fun, fast, and practical. The platform has hundreds of short tutorial videos, each of which is paired with a set of step-by-step instructions that get you using AI tools in minutes, not hours, and certainly not days. For those of you who haven't signed up yet but want to check it out, in May, I am running a special NLW cohort. What this means is that people who sign up with the code NLWMAY will get $5 off their first month, but they'll also have access to a private channel in our Discord with me. I'll be handpicking tutorials each week that I think are the most useful to start with, and I'll also be available for questions, advice, and feedback from this group. Spots for this cohort are limited, so if you want to be a part of it, again, sign up at bsuper.ai with code NLWMAY. That's bsuper.ai with code NLWMAY. Anyway, our second big story for today, the IRS has published the first set of forms specifically designed for crypto reporting. The draft forms are part of a proposed rule which would require crypto brokers to report on user transactions occurring within their ecosystem. The form includes categories of brokers defined as crypto kiosks, digital asset payment processors, hosted wallet providers, and, most troublingly, unhosted wallet providers. The form suggests that the IRS and the Treasury have not backed down from efforts to impose reporting requirements on self-hosted wallets, with all of the compliance issues that come along with that. This rule change came out of a provision inserted into the 2021 Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. It was designed as a way to pay for that spending bill, with the administration asserting that massive tax revenue could be raised by clamping down on crypto tax evasion. When the rule was proposed last August, the IRS said, quote, "With third-party information reporting that specifically identifies digital asset transactions, the IRS could more easily identify taxpayers with digital asset transactions that are otherwise difficult to discover." And although this might be a reasonable aim, industry groups have pointed out how unworkable reporting requirements for self-hosted wallets would be at every stage of public consultation. Ji Kim, the chief legal officer of the Crypto Council for Innovation, provided a summary of the issues, writing, "Unfortunate to see unhosted wallet providers being listed as brokers. This fails to recognize, among other things, that a wallet provider as a software tech provider does not have knowledge of the nature of transactions processed, nor the identity of the parties to the transaction. It is critical that the actual final regs take into account the unique nature of digital assets in our industry, especially to the extent that they impose obligations on individuals, tech, or entities that practically cannot comply with tax reporting requirements, not because they do not want to, but because they do not have, and in many cases cannot get, the requisite info to do so." And indeed, this is the crux of the issue, that self-hosted wallets do not have the personal and transaction information required to fill in forms accurately. One of the big practical issues is accurately reporting the cost basis of crypto trades. For example, say you purchased Bitcoin for $5,000 on an exchange in 2016, decided to self-custody last year, and then sold it this year. Your self-custody wallet has no knowledge of the price you paid for the Bitcoin initially, so you can't report your gains accurately. For this reason, industry tax experts have suggested that rules would be counterproductive. The IRS would receive a mountain of incomplete or inaccurate forms. The rule would also require decentralized exchanges to report with broadly the same issues. In a summary of the new form, Gordon Law Group noted that DEXs will likely be required to share information in order to accurately calculate the cost basis for users' assets. Gordon pointed out that crypto infrastructure has no way to differentiate between untaxed transfers between a user's wallet and taxable sales. Peter Van Valkenburg, the director of research at CoinCenter, took a bigger picture view, tweeting, "The inclusion of unhosted wallet provider in today's draft broker form indicates that the IRS is not heeding our warnings from last fall when the rule was open for comment. Continuing down this road will lead to tax policies that are contradictory to the statute passed by Congress and unconstitutional on both First and Fourth Amendment grounds." CoinCenter has previously pointed out that IRS reporting forms are only constitutionally sound because they rely on third-party data collected in the ordinary course of business. The argument being made here is that imposing reporting requirements on self-hosted wallet developers is categorically different to the reporting done by traditional stock brokerages. Van Valkenburg argues that these forms would mandate new data collection rather than acknowledging the reality of disintermediated crypto finance. Jake Travinsky, the chief legal officer at Variant Fund, suspects that this rule is heading for a frustrating but winnable legal battle, commenting, "Bad news. Despite years of industry engagement with IRS explaining why unhosted wallets can't be brokers, the message somehow hasn't landed. Good news, rules that make literally no sense at all rarely survive scrutiny in the courts. Great news, we really like filing lawsuits." When asked why the IRS thinks that self-hosted wallets are brokers, Travinsky gave a fairly glib assessment of the situation, saying, "They think people are evading taxes, and the only way they know to address that concern is through financial surveillance. And they don't accept the idea that there's technology allowing people to engage in peer-to-peer transactions without an intermediary who can KYC and report." Many commented that this was yet another example of this administration focusing resources on the wrong thing. Crypto lawyer Gabriel Shapiro wrote, "It remains absolutely wild the amount of clearly, indisputably illegal things in crypto that regulators do not go after while pursuing crazed theories like unhosted wallets being brokers can only be explained by wanting to discredit and destroy crypto." The administration is currently aiming to bring these rules into force for the 2025 tax year. There's still some time to argue against the form and the associated rules. However, if the IRS and the Treasury were going to back down from their stance that self-hosted wallets are brokers, it seems likely that they would have done it months ago in response to public comment. So for now, we have to assume that this issue will be added to the long list of unworkable regulations that need to be challenged in court. So friends, two very interesting things regarding the US government and its continued battle against the crypto industry. We may be in a bull market, but the fight has not left the building. That, however, is going to do it for today's breakdown. Big thank you to my sponsor for today's show. Check out the Ledger Orange Bitcoin Nano. 5% of sales go to support Bitcoin development. Until next time, be safe and take care of each other. Peace.